Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Daisha Eaton of KSK, and Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Breaking news this morning, Friday, here in Anchorage and all over North America, for that matter, by telephone, Skype, and so forth, the EPA has a major decision on PEBL.
Yes, they held a teleconference early this morning announcing that they're going to use 404C, that's a section of the Clean Water Act, to halt development of the PEBL mine in southwest Alaska. And it's been several years coming. The tribes of that region originally requested that the EPA step in and do a bunch of investigation. They did a bunch of scientific research studies, and they announced today that they will be beginning that process. Now, the 404C process is a year-long process, most likely. It'll probably take about a year. And we have yet to hear exactly how that will work. But as one reporter said during the press conference, so is this kind of like you're saying no, but if you have anything else to show us, you better do it now?
You mean the PEBL partnership?
The PEBL partnership, yeah. And the EPA authorities said, yes, that's absolutely right. So we are saying no, but if you have anything else that you want to enlighten us with, now is the time.
And Steve, all of this takes place in the context, a political context, and immediately this becomes an important political matter for the candidates for statewide office.
Absolutely. We haven't really heard a whole lot of reaction. Daisha has talked about the news conference this morning, but we haven't gotten a whole lot of reaction just yet here on this Friday. But there have been already, ground has already been set aside for candidates who say we're tired of federal overreach. Certainly Governor Parnell will probably hear that slogan come out again later on today when the governor weighs in on all of this. He's against federal overreach. The EPA is making a decision far too early in the process. And other candidates are running for Senate.
Mark Begich's response, the one we had his first response, maybe more developed, seemed a little bit odd in that he has come out against the mine and yet now was raising our old friend federal overreach.
Right. He's recited that same refrain a couple of weeks ago when the EPA report came out and wasn't so specific about talking about PEBL, but saying that, yes, a mine in that area would really destroy valuable habitat for salmon. Senator Begich came out and just was all for what the EPA had said in that report. This time, the release that's come out so far is, I'm really happy about what the EPA did, but this federal overreach stuff. So that's going to be a common theme, obviously.
Okay, we're going to have a lot of time for politics as this develops. Mm-hmm. But right now, we need to move on. Steve, education and education funding remained deeply contentious in Juneau. We could do an entire show on the causes of that contention, but give us the overview. Why is the legislature so torn up by education policy and education funding?
I think you've got every possible conflict that you can have politically and involved, embroiled in this debate. You've got candidates who are in the legislature who campaigned on the fact that I support education and a fully fund education, and I want smart kids and great schools, and now they're in the legislature.
And they could say that whether they were supported by the unions or not.
And if you were a Republican or Democrat, it didn't matter. Everybody, if you cover campaigns, and I've covered a few, you talk to the state legislators and the candidates who are running, they all say, we want great schools, we want smart kids. Nobody says, oh, no, I'm for stupid kids, and we're going to close the schools. That's not a good thing. So they all support it. They all say good things, and then they get to the legislature. So now you've got people who have said they support the school districts and they want to fund them fully. And all of a sudden, we've got the Anchorage School District, for instance, that's grappling with, a $23 million budget cut in its budget here, facing another $29 million in cuts next year. So you've got that going. You've got the Democrats that want to increase funding. You've got Republicans, Governor Sean Parnell, who says, I want to increase the student allotment for each student by $85.
And if I might, we have a task force the legislature has selected that was, in effect, denounced by the Chamber of Commerce head here in Anchorage, Andrew Halcrow,
who was a member of the task force.
An unusual development, to say the
absolutely.
Least.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then they have the outside forces. The Anchorage Chamber of Commerce has been very vocal in this, saying we need a strong school system to attract businesses and have a healthy economy. So you've got that kind of pressure. And then I think you've got Republicans against Republicans. You've got maybe moderate Republicans who are in favor of more school funding, and then you've got more conservative Republicans who are saying, you know, we need some cuts and we need school vouchers and we need to remove that clause in the Constitution that says, you know, we can take public funds and give it to religious schools, for instance. So you've got all these conflicts that are going across the board, and we'll see what
happens. Let's get Dermot Cole in here. Yep. Dermot, Governor Parnell, as Steve alluded to, wants a constitutional amendment that will remove the prohibition on aid to private schools. But he's not talking about the financial cost. Explain.
Well, the governor, in essence, said that the opponents of the amendment should come forward with details on how much this would cost, which is sort of a clever twist on things, because it's hard to put a cost on this. But really, the proponents of this haven't come up with solid numbers, and there have been very many estimates as to what it would cost, really, to start funding private schools with public money. It all depends on how it's implemented. The proposal that's before the legislature now would amend the Constitution, and the backers of the proposed amendment say, as soon as we get that amendment passed, then we can talk about how much it will cost. So
the amendment, the amendment language would not have a fiscal note attached to it. I don't even know if it's expected to.
Yeah, well, it's the fiscal note attached to it is for a couple thousand dollars, which is how much it costs to put in the election pamphlet. If a policy is enacted, it will cost much more than that. But it's a strategic move by the proponents of the amendment to try and delay any discussion of the cost until after the amendment is in the Constitution. Opponents of the amendment say the time for that discussion is now. So as Steve said, this is one of the many complicated aspects of this education issue that are, you know, is underway now. The cross currents are incredible, this whole thing, and I'm not even sure how to begin to sort it all out, Mike.
Well, one thing I was struck by is Senator Mike Dunleavy, who's leading the forces who want to change the Constitution, has said repeatedly, "Let's have a vote. Let's have a vote." And meaning that in the public, let's have a vote. But it must mean that he doesn't have the votes in the legislature, otherwise they would vote. If you have the votes in the legislature, you vote, right?
That's right. You don't have to keep saying, let's have a vote. But, you know, in my columns, I've advocated for the point of view that we really ought to talk about the cost now, because otherwise people don't know for sure what they're voting on. Unless you want to trust that you vote to give the legislature this authority and then determine how much it will cost.
Okay, Desha, speaking of costs, the Anchorage School District passes a budget for the coming year. The board reduced its spending by some $23 million, and there will be layoffs. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's been happening since I've been reporting in Anchorage these past couple of years, and it's happening again, $23 million. It's going to equal around 200 positions lost. The school district actually dug into their reserve funds, and they had to change their charter to do that. So it was pretty serious. There was a lot of debate about whether they should be doing that, because it sets a precedent, a dangerous precedent, of going into savings. And they dug out a tiny bit of money just to save, I think it was 19 counselors and teachers for the most kind of at-risk children. And this spring, the pink slips will be going out to about 200 people, and they're looking at $29 million in cuts next year. Of course, we haven't heard whether or not the governor, his proposal to increase the base student allocation by a little bit is going to go through. If it does go through, that might change things a little bit. But it just brings you to the fact that every year, the poor school district has to go through this because there is no long-term funding, and because the funding for education in the state is not linked to the cost of living increases that happen.
And the school district doesn't have taxing power, which leads me to this question. They have a reserve. Since they don't tax, where's that money come from that's in their reserve?
That's a good question. I'm not sure exactly where it comes from, but I know it's about 8% that they keep in there for emergencies.
And there may also be, we're speaking in ignorance here, this is something we should check out, that there may be even some requirement of that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dermot, the announcement that the Flint Hills refinery in North Pole will close is big news in the Fairbanks area. Workers will lose their jobs. There will be expensive cleanup in the future. The political fallout is extensive already. You've been covering Fairbanks, the Fairbanks area, since just about the time the refinery was built. Sort out the facts for us, which are, seem to be complex and many.
That's right, Mike. It's an ancient refinery. Began operations in 1977. Mm-hmm. Flint Hills, which is a subsidiary of Koch Industries, says that on top of this, what it said was a highly competitive situation, I guess uncompetitive. They said it can't really compete with the cost of fuel that it's imported into Alaska, jet fuel and Anchorage mainly, that the cost of a large sulfalane spill cleanup is really making the refinery impossible to continue in operation. Right now, there's at least a couple things going on. There is pressure and a political activity going on in Juneau to try and change the conditions for the cleanup so that if there is a potential buyer, which there may be, that buyer wouldn't face, have to deal with the cost of the cleanup of the sulfalane spill. Sulfalane is a solvent that's spilled into the ground over many years and is now in a plume about 3 miles long by 2.5 miles wide from the refinery. It's not in excessively high concentrations, but it is high enough to really warrant concern. The refinery is going to close in the spring. That seems pretty clear. It will remain open only if there is a buyer to take over the property. Flint Hills is saying there's a whole range of conditions that it would like to have met before it considers a sale. And one at the top is that liability for Flint Hills be limited, and that the former owner of the refinery, the Williams Companies, be required to pay a significant part of the cleanup, and that the state would also have to pay for the cleanup, because the state used to own the land, and under state law, the landowner is one of the responsible parties.
Now, Dermot, the governor intervened here, Governor Parnell intervened, to say that he, at least personally, or his administration, would not hold any buyer liable for what may have happened in the past. Explain that to us, and how binding is this?
Well, it's a strategy that really took, for instance, I checked with Flint Hills. They said they did know that the governor was going to make this announcement, which came out on Thursday on the governor's Facebook page. It seems to be a step to try and increase the chances that Flint Hills will sell the refinery to another group. In essence, the governor is saying, if a buyer comes in, the state will say, your liability, you do not have liability for these past spills of sulfalane, and that you'll sort of start with a clean slate. That makes it likely that the buyer will be found. What's still to be resolved is who's going to pay for the cleanup, and that is the former owner, the former would be Flint Hills, Williams, which used to own the refinery, and the state. That has yet to be apportioned. And we don't know yet if this strategy is going to work, Mike, or if there will be a buyer.
And of course, the governor's policy or proclamation or point of perspective can't bind the federal government if the Environmental Protection Agency wanted to get involved in this.
That's true. I think in the end, what it looks like is a higher bill for the state. The state is going to have to be picking up a significant share of this cost. And you know, that is immediately going to make it more of a political issue than it already is.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Daisha Eaton, and Dermot Cole. Steve, Channel 2 did a series, Inside Alaska Prisons. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this series. Tell us about what it revealed. One thing it revealed is you put a lot of time and effort into this.
Reporter Corey Ellen Young did the story. Also, photographer Sean Wilson went in with him as well. And it was a series that I think gave us all a glimpse of a place that hopefully we don't have to ever go into, But it was a good chance to see what life's like behind bars, not only for the inmates, but certainly for the guards who have to keep them safe and keep them under control as well. Talked about how a lot of the inmates are looking for looking to rehabilitate themselves, get out, take advantage of the programs that are offered in prison, electrical work, other kinds of vocations. And it seems that a lot of the inmates do indeed take advantage of that and try to come out with a skill set.
And how did you find inmates who were willing to go on camera? That's one of the striking things about
Corey was the one who did all the legwork on that. And that's a good question for Corey, but he did a great job. And I thought one of the more telling pieces was the final one, where he talked to an inmate who she had done her time. She had taken a vocation in prison, got out, but because of the fact that she was a convicted felon, even though she had done her time, she was having a very difficult time trying to find a job that would support her and her young son. So, and that is a big problem that folks coming out of prison after, doing
the film was definitely, the video was definitely telling of,
yep.
of what it had, how much wear and tear it had taken on her, that
yeah.
this is, it's tiresome just getting through the day when you have these kind of burdens.
It's a very stressful place for all involved, including the guards, and I guess correctional officers, I should call them. Guards is kind of an old, antiquated term, but the correctional officers, it's a stressful time for them. They have to be careful around the inmates, and it sounds like the vast majority of the population there is well-behaved and they want to do their time and they want to better themselves and then they want to get out and start their lives over, but there certainly is an element that make it a potentially dangerous place as well, and that does wear, and it wears on the other inmates as well as the correctional officers.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it right there. Dacia, we'll get Stephen here a little bit too. Anchorage municipal elections are barely a month away. Some perspective on the assembly.
Okay, let me just say one thing. Anchorage municipal elections are April 1st this year.
Yes, good point. Good
because I talked to the clerk at the clerk's office yesterday, and she said, please, Dacia, make sure everyone knows the election is happening, because they've all heard the election is being changed
good
from
point.
The spring to the fall. Mm-hmm. But that is not until 2017.
This is so, like daylight savings time or something.
Yeah. So she wants to make sure you all come out and vote on April 1st this year. So there are, I think, half a dozen assembly seats that are up before the voters. And there are two or three school board seats. I'm trying to remember.
Three. Yeah, I think
three school board seats.
Yeah.
Then there are seven propositions and two charter amendments. We won't get into all those. Mm. A couple of highlights, the seats that are most interesting, I think, is the East Anchorage seat with sitting assembly member Adam Trombley being challenged by Pete Peterson.
A former legislator
and a political insider. And all of a sudden, Mao Tosi, who, of course, has done tons of work with youth and been a real political activist in his neighborhood here in Anchorage and all over the state, he jumped in kind of as an outsider. And there seems to be some sort of a, like, surprise element to that. And, why are Pete Peterson and Mao Tosi running at the same time? And I've heard that there's been some discussion of that.
Let's get Stephen here
for
the
South Anchorage.
South Anchorage races.
Well, and I guess my qualifier is it's early, and I haven't really gotten a chance to get into all the candidates. But the South Anchorage race, it's a three-way race as of right now. Bill Evans is one of the candidates. He's probably the most visible right now. He's on the air. Yeah, I've heard some radio spots. He's got lots of signs up. I'm not sure what his opponents have done just yet as well. This is to replace Chris Birch, who is termed out. He's served three-year terms out there in South Anchorage. He was a huge proponent of Mayor Sullivan, pretty much backed whatever the mayor wanted to do. He backed it pretty much about 100%. So Chris Birch is out because of term limits, and so it's going to be a good race, I think, out in South Anchorage as well with these three candidates going. And Mao Tosi, I think, I predict, is going to be very formidable out there in East Anchorage, I think.
Okay, Dermot, you did a profile on U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan, who was candidate in the Republican primary. He's had several roles in the Parnell administration, but you went back into his history, particularly in Ohio. One thing you discovered is he definitely comes from money.
Yes, Dan Sullivan has been, you know, his association with Alaska really goes back to 1997, when he moved here, worked as a law clerk that worked in private practice, and he left the state in 2002 to work in the Bush administration in various capacities, and then returned to be attorney general in the Palin administration. Dan Sullivan grew up in Northeast Ohio, and his family is very prominent in that region. His brother is the chief executive of RPM International, which is a company that makes Rust-Oleum and a whole host of consumer products and industrial products. And the family connections in the Cleveland area really paid off for him in the last quarter of 2013. He raised more than $400,000 in the Cleveland area, in the greater Cleveland area, and had additional contributions from associated industries who have some connection to RPM.
And if I might, this firm and this family and their executives, they are big players at the national level too. If you go on to various websites where their campaign contributions are discussed, they contribute to the National Republican Party and obviously to elected officials and would-be candidates in Ohio, right?
That's correct. His brother in particular has been very active in the Republican Party and has close ties with national Republicans and has been involved since before the Bush administration. Obviously this presents a little of a delicate issue for Sullivan in the Senate race because he wants to campaign as and to focus, as all candidates do, on their Alaska ties. How he handles this becomes a bit of a challenge for him. Lieutenant Governor Mee Treadwell has taken him to task on this, on his Ohio connections. On the other hand, with all this, outside fundraising is the norm in these statewide races. And that's certainly true with Mark Begich, and it will be true with Sullivan and Treadwell if he succeeds in getting the GOP nomination.
Okay. Steve, the Iditarod begins Saturday. That's tomorrow. We're kind of taping on Friday. This is Alaska's best-known sporting event by far. At this point, the Iditarod enjoys not only national attention, but international attention. Even some of the mushers come from abroad. Mm-hmm. What have been some of the keys to the race's success?
Boy, I'll tell you, I think one of the main keys is it's become just about a 100% an Alaskan event over the years. There used to be a number of national sponsors, dog food sponsors, other companies, outdoor clothing outfitters used to be involved, and it was the special rights or the special interest groups, PETA, for instance, that put pressure on these sponsors to get out of the race because of boycotting their products and things. And so those sponsors fell away, and that put Iditarod in a real financial pinch. But a lot of Alaskan companies have come to the rescue. Anchorage Dodge dealership, GCI, Wells Fargo. It's a regional or perhaps even a national outfit, but it's based here. Or it's got plenty of branches here in Alaska. So they've come in and they've really helped out and supported the race. They've come up with some unique fundraising. The Iditarider, people will bid money to ride in the sled of one of the racers and things like that. So that's raised money. They've got a raffle that's pretty popular. So, and it's a uniquely Alaskan event.
This is like raffles where you can go to dinner with a member of the Green Bay Packers.
That kind of stuff. They've been pretty much thinking outside the box when it comes to their fundraising, and they've been able to put the race on pretty solid financial ground. And keep it that way. They've got a $2.5 million budget. They've got a $600,000 purse that they split amongst the first 30 finishers, and it's gotten worldwide attention.
Let me try something on you. One of the things that struck me in looking at the booklet this year that was in the Daily News, mm-hmm. and people have are interested in the race, is the growth and importance of history. Yeah. Because now the race has passed over some time. There are historic figures, or people who've won the the race many times. Mm-hmm. There are people who are very, very beloved who have been part of the race, like Didi Jeanreau, and who can resist the name Herbie Nyukpa? history, I think, is really helping them.
Yeah, the Shishmaref cannonball.
They've created a culture.
Yeah. That's right.
And a brand that you can't miss.
Yeah. Rick Swenson, the only five-time winner of the race, he's a legend. Women winning the race. You know, we all thought Susan Butcher would be the first, and then this young gal, Libby Riddles, came out of nowhere and was so brave to go out into the storm and put some distance between herself and the guys, you know, and that spawned the t-shirt that said, you know, Alaska, you know, where men are men and women win the Iditarod. it's got its history now. It's got a legacy. And now you get the CD family, the Mitch and the dynasties. the CD family has won the last two races, Dallas and Mitch, and it's going to be interesting to see if they can make it three in a row.
What I want to know is, how are they going to cope with this weather?
Yeah, good. wheels on the sleds. I don't know. There was an article. Craig Medrid did a story on Alaska Dispatch talking about the trails.
News from Alaska is it's not cold enough.
It's not cold
we're
enough.
We're going to have to quit right there.
Lots of hard ground.
We're over with Alaska Edition for this week. We'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.